Hello, and welcome to a special episode of House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell, and I am a political journalist. And I'm joined today, I'm delighted to say, by Aisha Hashirika and Tom Hamilton, who have a fantastic new book out all about Prime Minister's Questions called Punch and Judy Politics. Hello, Tom. Hello, Aisha.
Hello, hello. Emma.
So, first of all, Tom, why this book? Why now?
Why this book? Why now? Well, because it was an idea that actually Aisha had at the point at which we both stopped doing PMQs, having together worked on Ed Miliband's PMQs team and Harriet Harman's PMQs team. I then worked for a bit for Jeremy Corbyn because I left my job with Labour Party a little bit later than Aisha did. And when that was all over, Aisha had this idea of writing a book about PMQs and thinking that because we'd both got this experience of having done it and also hopefully the opportunity to talk to lots of other people who'd done it, that it might work, and that there was a bit of a gap in the market as well, because slightly to our surprise, no one's written a proper book about it yet, even though it's quite a significant bit of British politics and the British political week. So I give the credit to Aisha for sort of spotting the gap in the market.
And so, Aisha, this was your concept. Are you passionate about PMQs? Is it something you really love and enjoy?
I didn't think I did love it when I was doing it for over 5 years. It was the sort of bane of my life every Wednesday morning. But when I stopped working on it, I did sort of feel a big void, because I suddenly realised it had been such a huge part of, you know, my political life. It was a big part of the rhythm of the week. And I obviously felt slightly nostalgic. I also had just sort of lost my job, so I didn't quite know what to do with myself. So it sort of gave me a project. And obviously I still wanted to keep working with Tom. So I thought, ooh, I've spotted a gap in the market. And we should make sure that all that time we dedicated to PMQs, we could do something with it. But on a serious note, it is quite a unique privilege to get to be in the room preparing a political leader for Prime Minister's Questions. It is an honour. It's hard work, but it is also a real honour. So I did think it would be good to sort of capture that, to capture the pressure, the responsibility, as well as the sort of hard work you have to do. But also, you know, it's a real thrill to be part of PMQs. There's a lot of terror in it, but it is a real thrill. And you get this incredible bird's eye view of everything that is going on across the political landscape, because you have to be on top of everything. You have to be looking for angles, either attack lines or points of defence. So if you're a bit of a political geek, which I think Tom and I both are, it really is like one of the best jobs in Parliament.
I've been sort of following PMQs probably since the 1990s. It's something I sort of kept my eye on, and I never dreamed that I would ever work on it. And when I started working for the Labour Party, it wasn't with a view to working on PMQs. And I didn't get the various jobs that I got within the party thinking that that would happen. And I remember getting a call one Monday morning at 6:30 in the morning, woke me up from Polly Billington, who then worked for Ed, saying, can you be at a meeting in Ed's office at 8 this morning to discuss PMQs? Because someone else who was doing the job before me had just left. This was Ed's second ever PMQs. And I sort of dropped everything, had a rapid shower and get a dress and got on the train and got there in time for this 8 o'clock meeting. And it was sort of the most exciting thing that I'd ever been involved in. That PMQs was an absolute disaster, and I got completely smashed. But somehow I kept my job, and I hung on through his time as leader and a little beyond.
PMQs is a very divisive thing. I think some people love it and some people think absolutely hate it. Clearly you two are on the first side of that. But why do you think it's an important thing?
I think it's still a really, really important part of our democracy. And it's a very unique and special thing to British politics. The bad thing about it is the childish behaviour, the noise, the boisterous sort of heckling and all of that. But at its core, there is something I think very important about the most powerful man or woman in politics being, you know, dragged to the dispatch box every Wednesday at noon to face any question on any subject from any member of parliament from anywhere across the country. I think that as a spectacle and as a practice is a very important, healthy thing for democracy. The noise and the sort of childish behaviour, while lots of people are understandably pretty scathing about it, I think that level of discomfort makes PMQs so important. You want your political leaders to be stress tested to the maximum. If it was a sort of sanitised, easy run, then, you know, it wouldn't be what it is. And one of the things that really struck me was that everyone I spoke to, particularly overseas, particularly in America, said, wow, I wish we had something that came close to holding our president to account like you have with your prime minister, particularly now with Trump. But there's also other important reasons. It's important for party management. It's important to get a media message out. And it's a good environment in which to test big political messages as well.
I mean, in terms of the leadership, it is a very particular model of leadership, isn't it? That kind of, it's quite macho, you know, you don't have to be a bloke, but you have to behave in quite a macho way to win at PMQs. You have to have the right put down. You have to have the, you know, the big clunking fist in some ways. Tom, do you think that this is, is there another kind of leadership that wouldn't work at PMQs or another way of doing it?
Well, you have to be quite dominant to do well at PMQs, which isn't necessarily, I don't think we should necessarily think of that as a masculine trait, although it sometimes has been. But you need to be able to control the room, to hold the audience, to deal with heckles and shouts coming at you. And in that sense, it is a performance in a way that some other parts of politics are not performance, although, you know, it's not the only part of politics that is. People who, you know, actors or stand-up comedians, of course, Aisha has a lot of experience of that, also have to sort of hold the attention of a room. And if you lose the room, then the performance ends up being a dismal failure. And we've seen leaders of the opposition and prime ministers who've done that. There are other approaches, and different prime ministers have found, or different leaders have found, ways of taking a bit of the heat out of it. Early on in his time doing it, Jeremy Corbyn used crowdsource questions, and he got people to email in, which meant that the whole thing was much lower key, because the Prime Minister can't yell at random blameless members of the public who are asking questions. So it did sort of diffuse the atmosphere a bit. The downside of it was that they weren't generally particularly difficult questions, so the Prime Minister wasn't under a massive amount of pressure. And what we've seen in recent months is that Corbyn has largely abandoned that approach. I can't remember when the last time he did a crowdsourced question was, but it was a while back. And he's been, you know, I think in recent weeks, much more effective by asking tight, difficult questions that you'd never have got in from members of the public, because they wouldn't have been able to, you know, it would have taken too long to crowdsource them. And which have build a logical argument as the PMQ session goes on, which you, again, can't really do with public questions. One of the problems with trying to sort of defuse it is that part of the implication of doing that is that you're being less combative, being less interested in sort of winning, because it is a very win-lose situation. And if you decide unilaterally not to try and win at PMQs, then your opponent probably will win at PMQs. And that then means that you've lost at PMQs, and that's really bad news in terms of party management, your own authority, your own ability to lead the party in other ways. So, you know, unless you have a sort of a mutual non-aggression pact, and it's very difficult to see why, you know, why the other side would agree to it if they could otherwise win. Unless you have that, then you have to keep on doing it, you know, to the best of your ability, whether you're the leader of the opposition or the prime minister, and that doesn't mean trying to win it.
And Emma, just one thing I wanted to just raise. I think it is a myth about that, you know, women don't like PMQs and men love it. I think that is too much of a generalisation, because certainly some of the best performers at PMQs at the dispatch box of late have been women, obviously. not Theresa May, but, you know, Harriet Harman, who I worked for, was excellent. Angela Eagle was very, very strong. Margaret Beckett was a very good performer. And Emily Thornberry, who is the kind of stand-in for Corbyn. And actually, a lot of women on the back benches love shouting and jeering as much as the men, sometimes more. I mean, look at someone like Anna Soubry, who has actually redefined her corner of the chamber as the naughty corner, because she and others make so much noise. So I do understand. I think it's more a personality trait. I think if you are the type of person, and I kind of completely understand this, if you don't like conflict, if you don't like confrontation, whether you're a man or a woman, you're going to hate Prime Minister's questions. But if you're somebody who does like your politics passionate, then you will like it. Angela Eagle told us this great kind of sort of expression of it. She said it's a bit like watching a football match and you're on the terraces and you sort of become part of this wall of noise and you feel so passionate about it. You're kind of part of the team. The noise that you're making makes you feel like you're on the pitch and you want your team, you want your man or woman to win. So this kind of almost quite primal sort of emotion takes over, because I think for a lot of people in Parliament, they are dead passionate and red-blooded about their politics.
Oh, absolutely. No, I mean, I think if you our regular listeners will know that in terms of passion, it's not necessarily a macho trait, I think there's a difference between macho and masculine, because I'm usually the one who's getting shouty and angry on our podcast, whereas Nick and Mark are a bit too laid back for my taste. but there are just different styles of leadership, and PMQ speaks very much to that one particular style, whether it's demonstrated by a man or a woman. I mean, there have been some really great performers over the years and some less good performers. I think you make quite clear in your book that Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn are not bringing the top of the PMQ's game at the moment, although both of them have had some improvement over time. I think you probably say that certainly in modern post-televised times, IDS was the worst PMQ's performer. Would that be fair to say?
He certainly wasn't great at it, and he only did it for a couple of years. And his failure to last as Tory leader was, well, it was down to various reasons, but I think his poor performances at PMQs were a big part of it. I mean, because he wasn't very good, his advisors, were people like David Cameron and George Osborne, people who went on to have very distinguished careers later, came up with this new technique, which was to ask really detailed sort of statistical questions, numerical questions. How many police officers are there in Birmingham? You know, how many social care places are there in Sutton? Things that the Prime Minister wouldn't know. And the idea was that he could then, that Blair would go, "I don't know the answer to that." And IDS would go, "Aha, you're not on top of your brief. I can tell you the answer." And then move on to the political point. And the problem was, well, there were two things. One is that it doesn't actually humiliate the Prime Minister, because no one expects him to have that level of detail. And so when he moves on to a sort of a more general policy answer in that area, but not with a specific number, no one thinks that he's rubbish as a result. And the other problem was that IDS was incredibly predictable. So it was Kevin Brennan, Labour MP, still a Labour MP, who he didn't bring down IDS, but there was a moment where IDS stood up, paused, and Kevin yelled out, "How many?" Which was always the start of the IDS question. You know, how many beds, how many police officers, how many nurses, whatever. And there was this pause. IDS looked up and just ploughed on with the "how many" question, sort of brought the house down because of his failure to adapt and think on his feet. And, that was sort of a nail in IDS's coffin. As I say, not the only reason that IDS didn't survive as leader, but it really, really didn't help. And actually, there have been, when I said earlier that Jeremy Corbyn has improved at PMQs, and he definitely has. Earlier on in his time, he was quite often doing PMQs relatively badly. It certainly didn't help his standing with the PLP, but the difference is that IDS and most other political leaders on both sides have been pretty dependent on the support of their parliamentary party. And if their parliamentary party thinks that you're bad at the job, then you don't last. I mean, Alistair Campbell told us that if Tony Blair hadn't been good at PMQs, then there's no way that he could have survived as Labour leader for as long as he did. And I think that's probably true. Because of the sort of the structure of Labour Party politics at the moment, Jeremy Corbyn can get away with not being good at PMQs, and it doesn't particularly threaten his leadership with the members because they're not watching PMQs in the same way that the PLP are. That's not to say, though, that it's not better to be good at PMQs than bad at PMQs. And, you know, his improvement is just indisputably a good thing for him and for the Labour Party.
One of the things I really like about the book is that each chapter looks at PMQs from a different perspective. So from the leader of the opposition, from the prime minister, from the backbenches, from the media. And it did strike me to think, you talk a lot about party management and how central that is to PMQs. Who is the real audience for this, Aisha?
Well, I think there are a number of different audiences. First of all, there are the people in the chamber. There are your own MPs, your troops. And the chamber is normally quite empty in Parliament, but generally people make an effort to come into the chamber. So first of all, it's your own MPs. And as Tom said, that can, you know, make or break how they respect you. They might not like you, but if you knock it out of the park at PMQs, they will respect you. We sometimes had some terrible PMQs with Ed, and then there was sort of, you know, talk of leadership challenges swirling around the tea rooms by about sort of 4 or 5 o'clock. So it's very, very important for your own kind of status. The next audience is the journalists. The lobby, they're the political journalists, they have a special pass that allows them to sit in the press gallery in the House of Commons. Again, you know, they're very, very busy people. Sometimes it's quite hard to fight to get their attention, particularly if you're an opposition party or one of the smaller parties or a backbench MP. So they all come into the House of Commons for Prime Minister's questions. So you have them as a captive audience. So it's a really, really important opportunity to, you know, show them and get your messages out there. Then there's the public. And not that many members of the public will sit and watch the whole of PMQs, but they will often catch a glimpse of it through the evening news bulletins. Traditionally, like back in the day, the news would always run a clip from the Prime Minister, the leader of the opposition, and possibly the leader of the third party as well. Now, those days have slightly gone, but Prime Minister's questions does still feature in the news. Just this week, the fact that Jeremy Corbyn did very, very well on Brexit did make it onto all the bulletins. But the new kind of audience is people through social media. And this is a really interesting new development in Prime Minister's questions. So lots of people now get a tiny glimpse of PMQs, but it's through what the individual parties decide to clip and use. And the Labour Party and Jeremy Corbyn's team have been highly effective with this. You often get the impression they use Prime Minister's questions not so much to get a clip on the news, but to get a little clip for social media so that they can get it out to, you know, the millions of people who will eventually sort of watch it once it's been shared. And the thing about Prime Minister's questions on social media is that both sides can declare victory. You can clip your boss, you know, in full flow being majestic, even if they lost 6-0 to the average viewer, you can clip their best bit and say, look, it was an absolute wipeout for us. So I think there are a number of different audiences for PMQs, but they all kind of knit together. And that's why the event is still relevant and important.
And do you think that social media aspect has changed it irrevocably, or is this just part of an ongoing evolution?
I think social media is always going to be part of how both sides look at PMQs from now on. But I think the way in which it's sometimes been used in recent months has been, I think it's not the most effective way, because it sort of prioritises social media wins over wins in the chamber. And that's, I think, a mistake. So as Aisha says, you can always find a clip, even in a bad PMQs, especially if you try and script it this way, in which your leader is saying the message that you would most like your site to hear, but it may not be all that relevant to the argument that you are actually making on the day. The thing to remember is that if you have a good PMQs, which is good because you've won it, because you beat the other side comprehensively, then that will pretty much inevitably create a really strong clip if you want it to. So, you know, you can just show the whole thing and the caption is, you know, here's our leader beating their leader. And that will get on the TV news probably, but it will still work just as well on social media as a clip saying, you know, that just lists the various government failures in a way that you then cut out the bit where the Prime Minister points out that it hasn't failed or it was your fault really, or you made a factual mistake or whatever it might be. So I just think it's slightly unambitious to tailor your PMQs towards social media rather than towards trying to win, which then gives you all the other benefits of victory.
I think we talk a lot and have talked a lot, and you talk a lot in your book about how PMQs sets the political mood and really feeds into the political mood and has been a game changer in terms of personnel. But are there moments where it's also changed policy, Aisha?
I wouldn't say PMQs is a sort of game-changing thing on sort of specific PMQs. I think we sort of described it as it's a sort of barometer and it nudges stuff along. You know, the famous kind of example, people say, well, you know, William Hague was really good at PMQs, but he never won an election. And that is absolutely, that's absolutely true. But he was in a very, very different position. His party had just been absolutely smashed by Tony Blair in 1997. They had literally nothing left. They didn't really have much of a party infrastructure left. And he used PMQs to give the party back a little bit of dignity. But what it does is it kind of sort of just tests the temperature of where the backbenchers are. And also in the heat of the chamber, if you say stuff on policy or you say stuff on message, it kind of is a bit of a sort of smell test. You know, if you say something which is just completely ridiculous, everybody will groan, including your own side. You know, you can't really get away with stuff that doesn't have a political truth in the House of Commons. It's quite sort of unforgiving from that point of view. So I think what PMQs does, it kind of sets a direction of travel. So, for example, take the period of time that Tom and I worked for Ed Miliband. The Conservatives very, very early on in that cycle started testing messages, and they just started doing them quite sort of gently. Then they started appearing more regularly. And by the time we got to the general election campaign in 2015, they had a set of devastating messages which had been tested through the chamber at PMQs. And then, of course, you made it onto posters. The general frame was you cannot trust Labour with the economy, don't give the keys back to the people who crashed the car. We were somehow responsible for the global financial crisis. You know, Ed Miliband was in the pockets of the trade unions. You can't trust somebody who did that to his brother. Now, they were all messages that first kind of surfaced at Prime Minister's questions from the mouth of the then Prime Minister, David Cameron. So it's not so much a kind of, you know, you have a game-changing moment at PMQs. It's almost like a sort of course is set and a course is sort of charted slowly but quite surely through the course of PMQs. And also, for example, just look at the difference before the snap election and then after the snap election. You know, PMQs captures where the political zeitgeist is. You know, you see Corbyn post that snap election when Labour did so much better than everybody thought and Theresa May lost her majority. There was almost a kind of power shift in terms of who was visibly more confident. And that, of course, was Jeremy Corbyn.
There's another sense in which PMQs helps to set policy. And you're right, it's very unusual it's not completely unheard of, but it's very unusual for PMQs to change policy in the sense that the Prime Minister stands up and says, actually, we're going to do something else instead. But what we try to bring out in the book is the way that PMQs helps governments and oppositions to think through what their weaknesses are and potentially to change policies before it gets to the point of them being challenged at PMQs, to realise that there's a problem with an area of policy and they're going to have to change it. They're going to have to create the fact that will make an answer more robust than they can truthfully say at the moment. And you might never see that happen as a spectator of PMQs, because it involves lots of work going on behind the scenes to make sure that the Prime Minister has a good, potentially quite boring answer to a question that could have caused huge problems if they hadn't sort of done the bomb proofing, the stress testing that comes with the fact that every week the Prime Minister is going to get, he's going to have to spend half an hour asking questions about goodness knows what from all sides, and you know, has to make sure that all of the answers on all areas of policy are absolutely convincing as possible. That doesn't mean that there aren't still policy failures in government, because of course there are lots, and we're aware of very many of them at the moment, but there'll be more that we're not aware of and that the government's aware of and that it's sorting out in time for the next PMQs, and we'll never hear about. Without that sort of weekly stress test, those problems, you know, they wouldn't get exposed in the same way, but they would grow in ways that they are not allowed to under the current system.
So if you were to start from scratch, design a new democracy, new parliament, new everything, would you change PMQs? Would this be how you would run this session?
Do you know something? I'm not sure if I would change that much about it, because I think it's very, very difficult to see how you would change it without losing the spirit of it, which I know a lot of people hate, but I still maintain that that is the thing that makes PMQs quite unique and, you know, quite passionate and quite sort of special. Although, you know, I'm not denying that it is sometimes incredibly childish, but I'm obviously quite an immature person. I like it, just do full disclosure there. So I probably wouldn't change that much of it. I mean, sometimes people say, oh, could you not? The only one thing I might do is, they're one of the great frustrations is that the Prime Minister never answers the question. And that has been since, you know, the TV cameras came in the late 1980s. So that's kind of time immemorial for PMQs. Maybe the one suggestion I would add is allowing the Speaker judiciously to call out the Prime Minister if he or she has really given an absolute, like, waffle-tastic answer, and able to sort of call them out and say, hang on a minute, you literally didn't answer the question, please come up and actually answer the question.
Maybe a gunge tank if they don't answer. If you want to be, keep it immature.
Or a custard pie.
Perfect.
I'll tell you the change I would make two changes, I think, if it was up to me. And this isn't in the book, this is just sort of something I thought about a bit as vaguely. I think it would improve it slightly. I would give the leader of the opposition 4 questions instead of 6, because I think 6 is often too many, and you can build a good argument over 4, and if you did, that would give a bit more time to everybody else. And then I would let backbenchers ask 2 questions rather than 1, because the problem with asking 1 question is, you know, however, well, you do get some brilliant backbench questions, but it's very difficult in 1 question to sort of set the Prime Minister up and then knock down the answer. So, you know, a lot of the time with backbench questions, you know what that first answer is going to be, but there's nothing you can do to stop it. But having a second question that would enable you to you know, anticipate that first answer, but then make it harder for the Prime Minister, I think would just, it would level the playing field a little bit at PMQs in a way that, you know, it would make the second half of PMQs a bit more interesting than it is.
That's very interesting. I mean, one of the things that struck me is how much time is spent on preparation for PMQs. I mean, I think I agree. I think your changes are very interesting, Tom, and I think that might well be worth looking at. But I agree that generally it's an important thing that the leaders are tested in this way on a regular basis and that it's done under these kind of stressful conditions. But does it have to be weekly?
It doesn't have to be weekly, but I think it's good that it is, honestly. I mean, there's a case for, and some people would still like to see it go back to twice a week, which of course it was until 1997, but it was not as long. It was 15 minutes twice a week instead of 30 minutes once a week. I think there haven't been that many prime ministers since then, but no prime minister since then has shown any inclination to move it back, because it would take even more time out of the week. But I think having it weekly is a good thing. I think having the prime minister of the day, the person that is, you know, in charge of everything, forcing them to be on top of everything once a week, I think is, you know, if it was just once a month, then it would be a bigger event, but I don't think it would be a better event, and I don't think it would necessarily make the Prime Minister more on top of things. So even if there are other changes that might be made to the structure of it, I think having it as frequent as it is a good thing.
You've spoken earlier and in the book about why the Jeremy Corbyn crowdsourcing hasn't really worked in terms of putting the pressure on the Prime Minister that you want to put on at PMQs. And I think that's right. But I think if you think about the moments in a Prime Minister's life that we think of as absolutely key when they were under most pressure, sometimes that is from the public. I'm thinking of Blair being confronted on the way into a hospital, Diana Gould questioning Margaret Thatcher really forensically over the Belgrano. Is there a space perhaps for maybe once a month, maybe twice a year, something like that, for this to be a public rather than a parliamentary event?
I don't know. I can see why that would be an interesting idea. And actually, at one point, Ed Miliband was very keen to sort of try and, I mean, that's partly because he absolutely hated PMQs. And I used to spend the car journey on the way in with him just going, oh God, why are we doing this? We're not just trying to get it scrapped by the time we get to 12 o'clock, please. But he sort of wanted to do a kind of a people's prime minister's question to get people. Now, I think you could sort of do that as a set piece. But again, I do think it's really important for our elected representatives to be able to stand, and not without social media and not without press officers and somebody else doing it for them. I think it's a really important test of an elected representative to be able to stand up and just deliver from their own mouth a coherent political forensic set of questions. I think that's really, really important. I do agree with you. I think you're absolutely right that sometimes it is a member of the public, but I think there are better sort of forums for that. And I wouldn't be against a sort of people's prime minister's question once in a while, but I do think we are slightly letting the politicians off the hook. And just looping back to the social media point, my anxiety is that because social media is now so, so important, it's clearly not going away. It's almost like a sort of get out of jail card. It's almost like you can stop trying to win in the chamber, just you as a human being, because somebody can kind of airbrush it for you and edit it to make you look triumphant. And I think at the end of the day, politics is the art of communication. And you as an MP, and particularly somebody, whether you're prime minister or leader of the opposition, two of the most important jobs in politics, you should be able to stand up there at the dispatch box and press an argument yourself or defend an argument.
Absolutely. So thank you both very much for joining me today. The book is out now. It's called Punch and Judy Politics. It's an absolutely forensic examination of PMQs. Given that it is half an hour a week, there is enormous amount of content and it looks at it from so many different angles. It's so interesting, particularly for total political nerds like me and I'm assuming my listeners. So thank you very, very much. Tom, Aisha, what are you up to next?
Well, I'm going to go and record another podcast, and then I've got to get cracking with writing my next project, which is my new stand-up show, which I'm taking to the Edinburgh Festival, which is all about where feminism goes next and why women are fighting each other about feminism, and it's called Girl on Girl.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I will be in Edinburgh for the last weekend, and I hope to catch that.
Lovely. I won't be there, unfortunately.
Oh, I'll have to come to the previews.
I'm going to do a run at the Soho Theatre in October, so do come.
Lovely. Okay, thank you very much, both of you. It just remains for me to say thank you to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for the theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.